Hello and welcome to I do feel like singing. This is 19.5 Nashy Cast. 19.5. See, I got the number right.
You did. You did. I'm proud. Everybody applaud.
And it's 19.5, therefore it is an in-betweener, and it's actually a Beyond Nashy episode. We like to do these occasionally. We have a lot of fun doing them. And if I haven't introduced myself already, I apologize. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we're here to delve into the first of two Beyond Nashy episodes focusing on another Spaniard filmmaker, one who did not do most of his work in his homeland. Did most of his work in France, I'd say, Portugal, a few other places. His name is Jess Franco, and if you are unaware of his work, some people would say you're lucky. 15 years ago, I would have said you're lucky. But tonight we're going to talk about one of my favorite Jess Franco films called A Virgin Among the Living Dead. Now, this is an interesting film. Yes, if you've never seen it, I recommend it. I think it's a good entry point for a certain subsection of his movies. Not all of them, because he made a lot of different kind of, well, he's still making movies. He's still alive today. So this is a good entry point for a certain type of Jess Franco film. And for me, it was the hardest form of Jess Franco film to warm to. It took me a very long time to find my way into these types of films that he made for a long period of time, starting in the late 60s through the early to mid-80s, I guess. He would occasionally return to this particular type of film. But both Troy and I came to this film years ago, and had kind of a brush up against it that was not pleasurable.
Yeah, not the best way to view it, to say the least.
I think you've told me before. How did you first see A Virgin Among the Living Dead?
And this was, I was still in high school. Amazingly enough, it did show on local television on the wonderful Channel 17 that I've mentioned from time to time. That would show some incredible stuff on there. I didn't see the whole film. I probably saw it listed in the paper, realized it was on, you know, saw the title, of course, Living Dead, you know, and it was actually, and it went by that title. It was definitely, I distinctly remember it was called A Virgin Among the Living Dead, and boy, did that sound interesting. And so I went to watch it. I think I probably caught the last of it, which maybe the last third of it, which, as we'll get into the sort of history of this film, and by the time I got to it, it was pretty much relying on showing the most predominantly the footage that was not really intended to be in the film from the first. And I remember just being completely befuddled by it, a bit bored and befuddled by it. And my best friend that I grew up with, Larry, we would often call each other, and when there was a horror movie on, we would sometimes like call each other on the phone and sort of watch the film together over the phone and you know, make commentary on it and, you know, talk about it as we watched it. So, and after watching a little bit of this film, I had to call him and said, are you watching this?
Are you seeing this thing?
And we'll get into a little bit later, a little bit more about, how this footage is just so inappropriate for this film. I just remember that was not a good way to, you know, to, then when I later, you know, when I later began to be familiar with European horror makers and with Jess Franco's name and saw that he'd made this film, I of course blamed him for what I had seen,
there are lots of films made by Jess Franco for whom we should, you know, throw brickbats. That I think he should hang his head in shame for. This is not one of them.
No,
although
I know,
it has been up until just the past few years, especially here in the U.S., really hard to see the film he intended.
Yeah. No, you're right. He's done a lot, and he's done enough on his own to bring about the reputation he has in some circles. Yeah. But yeah, for this particular film, he is not to blame for what most people have seen think of as the film's version, the definitive version.
Well, the way I first came across the film was in the late '90s. I picked up a videotape at the time. I can't remember. I cannot for the life of me remember what video company it was, but they were issuing a lot of Euro horror, and any film that they could get their hands on that they could, in any way, shape, or form, rename zombie, fill in the blank with a number, and then the actual title of the film, that's what they did.
Yeah.
So I, being the, you know, the very young, naive Euro horror fan that I was in the 90s was tracking, you know, was grabbing every one of them that I could get my hands on just as quickly as I could. And this videotape stood out. It was Zombie 4, colon, A Virgin Among the Living Dead. So, picked it up, didn't know at the time, knew, I may have read Jess Franco's name some, I mean, I'm sure I had. I knew the name in some way or another, but I don't know that I knew enough about his filmography to have a clue as to what I might be checking out here. So, picked it up and watched it, and it was the hideous version of the film that is kind of chopped to ribbons and has all of the stuff inserted into it that were all the scenes that were filmed by French filmmaker Jean Roland at the behest of the producer of the film, who basically was faced with the fact that he had a movie on his hands called A Virgin Among the Living Dead, and there were no zombies in the film. And this made it a tough sell as far as he was concerned, especially to English-speaking audiences, a.k.a. the drive-in audience, a.k.a. stupid damned Americans who see Living Dead in a title and want, you know, zombies. So he was, the producer essentially had a movie filled with ghosts instead of zombies. And this would just not work. So he had Jean Roland, a filmmaker who I admire.
He's done some good work, you know,
He's done a lot of good work, and he's done the occasional piece of crap, too, don't get me wrong. But the stuff that he filmed, the version I saw on that videotape was the version with his stuff inserted into the film as, quote-unquote, dream sequences throughout it. And it was a disaster. It was a nightmare to watch because the secret of how effective this film is very easily destroyed. The thing that makes it so effective can very easily be destroyed, and the best way to destroy it is to insert completely tonally different sequences throughout it. And that is exactly what they did. So they turned it into an utter nightmare. And the funniest thing about this, I wish I still had this videotape.
Going from nightmarish to nightmare.
Pretty much. The funniest thing about this videotape is that there's a lot of nudity in this film, by the way. A goodly amount. The female lead spends, Christina von Blank, spends, oh God, I'd say well over 50% of the runtime in some form of undress. Not a problem as far as I'm concerned.
I bet you're going to say you're attracted to her, aren't
you? Well, man, I'd have to think about that. I guess she was kind of attractive. I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. But there's a lot of nudity in the film, and the way they decided at some point, I'm wondering if what was on this videotape was the version that was released for television or something.
Let me ask you this. I can tell you one thing. I can ask you this. Did the stuff, once it starts getting into the heavily towards the last third of it, did it keep repeating the stuff that Jean Roland filmed over?
No. That's not what I'm talking about. This is something I've not seen ever since having watched the film on this particular videotape. Here's the weirdest part of the videotape. During sequences in which it's very clear there's nudity, they're masking the nudity out of the image with not black bars, but just like diagonal black chunks covering part of the picture. I'm not making this up, man. I mean, so in other words, say you have a shot of Christina lying on a bed, her head to the right of the image. There'll be this slash across the image so that you can't see her naked body and can only see her in the bed from the neck up. And it's very obvious. It's very obvious what they're doing. They're masking the image. So I kept looking at it and going, oh my God. So the only thing that would have actually kept me interested in this abortion of a film, this nightmare, that's an amalgamation of two things at the time. I didn't know it was an amalgamation of two different filmmakers being mashed together. The only thing that would have kept me interested, a lot of nudity, was being covered up by essentially big black bars of crap to make this print of the film possible to be shown on television, I assume. I don't know if this version of the film was ever shown on television, but it was definitely cleaned up enough so that it could be.
In the version that I saw, here's the interesting thing about it, because, you know, you think about it, if you watched this film and you thought, if we can't get, who is the one filmmaker that you were, would you want to get to film, besides Franco, to film the scenes for this particular type of movie, you would think Jean Roland would be a great choice. Because so much of this film, tonally, it's so much of like what Jean Roland filmed, you know, in this, so that whole dreamlike sort of sense there. But yeah, it went horribly wrong in this case, you know, it just, but when I saw it, I mean, I know to this day, I mean, it's I don't know what they did. Maybe it was just because of so much was cut out, or maybe they were trying to expand it to fill up a 2-hour slot is a possibility. But there's a point in the last third of the film where it goes on this loop that just loops and loops and loops, with the main character going back through this sequence over and over.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so you know what
now,
I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. Luckily, that's not in the real version
of
the film.
Right.
But yes, I do believe that maybe that was in that videotape.
Yes,
too.
Because that's what me and my friend, when we were talking on the phone, was like, we'd be going, they're starting it again. It's happening again, you know, because it would keep going back to her, you know, her starting this sequence again. And it was just so repetitious and so monotonous, and it was
driving me nuts.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that is that the film itself, without, you know, we're not going to spoil this one or give away too much of the plot things, but in a lot of ways, there's very much in the film within the story that is circular, that almost happens on a loop itself, but it's very elegantly done. It's very cleverly done. You know, what Roland did was, you know, this version I saw on TV basically just took that and just made it just this incredibly annoying, obvious thing. It was like a record skipping, you know, again. And
that's true. Well, one of the things we should point out is that the Franco version of the film, the real version of the film, the version that we'll be talking about tonight, is a short film to begin with.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It is barely 78 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little over an hour and 15 minutes long. So back in those days, to fill a TV time slot, they would probably have had to find some way to extend it.
Yeah.
And so that would make sense. So
I think that's what we were seeing.
You saw it on television.
I did, yeah.
So definitely what you were seeing was a television print, and I think that's probably what was on that god-awful videotape that I had.
Yeah.
So there you go. And what's wild about that, I mean, the videotape I was... was a pre-recorded tape I bought in a store. I mean, it's not like it was a bootleg. So this is the way the film was sold. My guess is that was probably taken off of a 16mm print somewhere.
Yeah.
But that's how a lot of people saw this movie for years here in the States, until unless you went the bootlegger route, of course.
Yeah.
Until Image released their current DVD of it, still in print, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Euro Horror Collection. And what's great is that it's got the correct version of the film. It's got the French language track with very good subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
And as an extra, it actually has those Jean Roland the sequences Jean Roland shot as an extra, so you can see this stuff.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. I think when you watch the Jean Roland footage, just all put together in one big chunk, there's some good stuff in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't,
yeah,
there's some you, nice... Okay, yeah, so you feel nice, that
I
way
have
as well.
Watched, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah, I do. I mean, I think it's obvious that he didn't have a whole lot of time or budget, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The zombies aren't really all that effective looking, but some of the things they do in some of the shots, there's definitely atmosphere to some of the things he does, you know. So.
Well, some of the stuff in the footage...
The locations are nice.
Oh, yeah. When she's walking through the forest and... The zombies rise up out of those piles of leaves and things like that. Some very nice, creepy, atmospheric stuff.
Yeah.
There's even some nice, creepy, atmospheric stuff kind of scattered throughout the footage. It's about 11 to 12 minutes of footage.
Right.
And about half of it, honestly, is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And you can see the hand of a filmmaker who knows how to put this stuff on film. But the rest of it, and part of this is just because this is raw footage cut together outside of the context of the film. Mm-hmm. A lot of it just looks really silly. Point of view shots where the zombies are looking down at
menace the camera.
Menacing
at the camera, and it's just
and it's really hokey and stupid looking. And it's just immediately the kind of thing where you're going, well, a good director would have shot all of this and then used pieces of it, the fiercest looking pieces of it, to edit into a scene to get it to look nice and effective. Mm-hmm. And seeing the raw footage,
it's like Dr. Tongue's 3D something or other.
Dr. Tongue's 3D House of Fucking Up a Film. That's exactly what I think it is. But
Count Floyd Among the Living Dead. Yeah,
but this being a Beyond Nashy Cast episode, we're not going to spoil the film, although I don't know how we really could spoil this film, because once we get to it, I'll be honest, I can tell you the plot of this film in one damn sentence, and I won't use a whole lot of words. So I don't know how effectively the film can be spoiled, but we will try to keep from spoiling it, because I think this is a film that it rewards viewings, and in my opinion, I think it rewards repeat viewings. Mm-hmm. I've watched this film probably, I think, four times over the past few years. It's a beautiful film, a lyrical film, and I think, mm-hmm. well, when we get into the discussion of it, I think you'll see what I'm talking about. Before we get into the main discussion of it, I do think it'd be fun to go ahead and, before we take our little break and, mm-hmm. and launch into it, we'll take a break here in a second, and you'll hear some music from the film, and then we'll get into a discussion of the film itself. But this is a movie, if you hadn't already guessed, that has been known under a lot of different titles mm-hmm. around the world, and we're just going to run down a few of them. First of all, the funniest thing about this is that, although if you know this film, you're going to know it under the title A Virgin Among yeah. the Living Dead, mm-hmm. the way you find it on the Internet Movie Database is under the title Christine, Princess of Eroticism.
Yeah, I don't know where they pulled that one out.
I've never seen poster art with that title. Yeah. I don't have a damn clue. Well, maybe I just haven't done enough of a mm-hmm. enough of a hunt. It claims that Christine, Princess of Eroticism was the original title. Maybe it was, and maybe yeah, I'm just maybe. Clueless on this. Maybe I haven't researched this well enough to know, but at any rate, that's one title. Then there's Virgin Among the Living Dead. Among the Living Dead, oh God, I can't translate some of this. Something about zombie cannibals?
Let's see.
I don't even have a clue. Oh God, I'm not going to try the Spanish one because then Elena will rake me over the coals. Nevertheless, most of them are variations on mm. either the Christine title, the Christina title, mm-hmm. or something, yada, 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 La Mort mm. Vivante, which actually, in France, it appears to be just, you know, the French translation of A Virgin Among the Living Dead, which is cool. But
no, you're right. The Italian one had to throw the cannibali in there, and something to do with, like, something about cannibalism in it.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know. Well, it had two titles in Italy, one that involved the word zombie and cannibal, and one that involved Christine and erotic. So
they were obviously trying for two different markets there. So
hey, whatever works. Yeah. You got to think this movie was made in 1973. I think that, and that's when it was released generally.
At least it wasn't called Christina on the Planet Ape. Sorry they didn't try that one.
Oh, well, now see there, Christine Among the Living Dead Apes. How's that?
Yeah, I like it.
That would be good. I'd pay good money to see that, right? Oh, my. Okay, well, known under a number of titles, it's Virgin Among the Living Dead from 1973, directed and written by Jess Franco. Mm-hmm. And we'll take a quick break and come back and talk to you about it.
Thank you.
The Haunting Love Theme.
Yes.
From Virgin Among the Living Dead. Let's talk about the music before we jump into
it's a heavy hitter who did the music here.
Yes. The music in this film was done by Bruno Nicolai, who is one of my favorite Eurotrash score producers. He was a fantastic musician, known primarily as the man who worked extensively with Ennio Morricone as Morricone's music arranger, the man who actually worked with the musicians to orchestrate Morricone's scores. Worked with him, all the way back to the spaghetti western stuff that he did in the 60s and that kind of thing. Nicolai, I've been a huge fan of his stuff. I was telling you before we recorded, I'm a huge fan of the music he did for a lot of Eurospy films in the 60s. He did music for Caligula in 79. Wow. He did music for so many things. The Big Gun Down, which I think is just a fantastic film. He did a number of scores for Jess Franco films, including Count Dracula, which we will talk about in a future episode. He did some great scores for a lot of giallos, like The Case of the Bloody Iris, Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key, All the Colors of the Dark. You know, I've still never seen When Women Lost Their Tails.
I actually have.
Have you?
I have. It's because I was a, if I recall right, Cinta Burger's in it. I was definitely a big Cinta Burger fan, and that's what... That's what compelled me to watch it.
that would compel me to.
Yeah, yeah. Now I know there's also a sequel to that film, and I'm pretty sure though that it is that first When Women Lost Their Tails is the one that I've seen.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's been years and years ago, but it actually was just again turned up on TV one night, obviously in a dubbed version, and the only thing I remember about it, you know, of course, it's a broad European farce, the humor is pretty unsubtle in it, you know, it's pretty much, you know, slapstick, very, you know, broad humor, but...
Still sounds like it might be worth
it. Yeah, it's, you know, I would definitely visit it again for sure, you know, I'd definitely be willing to watch it again because it has been a long, long time.
Well, Bruno Nicolai is an amazing composer, was an amazing composer. Big fan of his stuff. I've never heard anything with his name attached to it that I didn't find some real joy in. So you'll get to hear a couple of pieces, or you just heard a piece of his score, and I'll end the podcast with I guess what we call the haunting pastoral theme, which ends the movie as well.
Yeah, when that gets in your head and will not leave, believe me.
That's wonderful, just a great wonderful music. If this film had nothing else going for it, the score would be a keeper, to say the least. Okay, brief plot synopsis. As I said before, we can probably give you a plot synopsis of this film that is pretty simplistic.
Yeah.
Christina Benton, played by Christina von Blank, lives in London, but she is she's traveled to to essentially her father's castle at Montserrat,
right?
At first I thought it was in France. So I think it's supposed to be in France. They're speaking French. Mm-hmm. Most of the cast is actually speaking French, regardless of the dub that you're seeing because of that. But although the film was... I'm getting off track really bad. The film was shot in Portugal is what I'm trying to get across. It takes place in France. Mm-hmm. But Christina Benton has come to France for the reading of her father's will. Mm-hmm. Now, she has never met her father. Mm-hmm. She was raised away from her parents. Her mother had died when she was young, and she never met her father. She was raised in schools away from him, and so his death is the first time she's ever even visited this castle in the ancestral family homelands of this large valley of Montserrat in France. So there you have the essential plot. She's come for the reading of his will. She's excited to finally meet the rest of her extended family, and that's really about all you need to know.
Yeah.
That's the plot. That's all it boils down to. This isn't an action movie. Mm-hmm. It's not high drama. Mm-hmm. Certainly not melodrama. Mm-hmm. But
when she's staying, the place she's staying in town while she's waiting to be picked up and taken to her father's home, we already get a pretty much a quick taste of a sort of recurring thing throughout the movie, When she meets anyone outside of that castle and refers to it, they always come back with, nobody lives there. You know?
Yeah, why are you going there?
Why are you going there? There's nobody there. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, they say that nobody lives in the entire valley.
Yeah, right.
All in the entire area. Why, why are you going there? Mm-hmm. And of course, she brushes this aside constantly, going, well, of course people live there. And once she gets there and meets her Uncle Howard and her aunts, and she gets, all the various members of the extended family, well, okay, yeah, there they are. Except that she's the only one that seems to interact with them.
Right.
And everyone else continues to insist that no one else lives there. Now, I said earlier that this is my favorite example of a certain type of Jess Franco film. Let me explain what type of Jess Franco film I'm talking about. Franco made a variety of different kinds of movies throughout his career. He made everything from straight horror to weird kinky horror to adventure films. He made some Eurospy movies. He even made a couple of historical dramas, things like The Bloody Judge and things of that nature. He made a couple of Fu Manchu movies. Some of my favorite of his movies are the movies that are kind of like Pulp Fiction or comic books done on film. Now, these are movies like, the Fu Manchu movies and his version of Million Eyes of Sumeru and things like that, which is also known as Girl from Rio. Things like that. Very interesting stuff. But starting in the late 60s, when he was able to get a little more ability to stretch, and especially when he learned how to work on extremely low budget. I'm talking very small budgets for most of these films, including this movie. He started to explore a certain type of film that one could almost refer to as a plotless exercise in pure cinema.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that there wasn't some type of story in most cases, but it's a very thin story, and these movies are almost always more about imparting a mood.
Yeah, mood, or atmosphere, visuals, and just, evoking a kind of taking you along. You know, it's like sort of a ride through his imagination there
almost through his psyche, a psychosexual trip through an odd place, exploring problems, ideas, thoughts that would crop up again and again and again as he made different types of different films of this type, often remaking the same story with slight variations over a course of years, as if he were attempting to refine or come to grips with certain ideas, certain ways of looking at cinema and how you experience cinema and life itself by refilming, rewriting, and playing with these same ideas and stories with a different cast, with different actors that might have a different take on some of these ideas themselves. So it's kind of fascinating to watch these types of films, but they're very difficult for a newcomer to get into. They're dreamlike. They're slow. I'll tell you they're slow. They are. Okay, because not a lot happens in these movies.
Right.
There's no plot to speak of. There's a story there, but sometimes it may take an hour before you even start to picture in your head or even grasp tangentially what the story might be aiming for.
Yeah, there's no classic, first, second, and third act kind of thing. No. You know, it's not interested in connecting the dots for you.
No. And the beauty of these movies, well, let me back up, because I'll tell you right now, they're hard to get into. It was these types of movies, the ones that I'm now championing, I'm playing champion to right now. I'm telling you right now, I am championing, well, I can't even talk. These films, I think they're fantastic. I don't think all of them are fantastic, but I think that's just the nature of these types of films. But I'll tell you, if these types of Franco movies were your entry point, they might stop you dead. You might think, as I did for years, this guy's an incompetent, boring hack, and just walk away from it, say to hell with it.
But I would say, if you there's certain type of other filmmakers that, you know, if you really gravitate to their work, I could see, you know, you might be able to, you know, you might enjoy these. Like, I'm thinking Terrence Malick, I'm thinking David Lynch.
Yeah.
Of course, Jean Roland, for sure. You know, certainly. It's like, if the films that those guys make, you know, if you're able to really, if those really grab you, then, you know, then that type of person might be able to take this kind of film, like Virgin Among the Living Dead, and kind of go with it. But I certainly agree with you. It's not the film that I would introduce a potential Franco fan to. To be honest with you, I'm not sure if I've found that film yet. And now, even though I've liked several of his films, I don't know. Maybe Dr. Orloff, if somebody likes classic horror.
Well, see, that's just it.
What would be the intro film? And you've seen so much more of his films than I have. And so for me, even though I've enjoyed several of his films I've seen, I don't know which, if any of them, are ones that I would say.
If I had to make a list of the five Franco movies that I would think would be a good entry point for someone,
mm-hmm.
the list would probably start with The Diabolical Dr. Z.
That's a good one.
Awful Dr. Orloff.
Mm-hmm.
Night of the Skulls,
mm-hmm.
from the mid-70s.
One, yeah.
All of these are accessible, pulpy tales,
mm-hmm.
Horror stories to one degree or another.
Mm-hmm.
Nicely plotted tales.
Mm-hmm.
I might even point them toward, maybe Girl from Rio,
mm-hmm.
which is a fun comic booky Euro spy mm-hmm. style thing.
Yeah.
If you could find it, I would point you toward Lucky the Inscrutable, which is one of the funniest damn mm-hmm. Euro spy comedies mm-hmm. I have ever seen in my life. I think mm-hmm. it's easily one of my favorite Franco movies. Just an absolute riot from beginning to end. Extremely funny. Then I might say, once you've seen one or two of those,
mm-hmm.
I might actually say, then watch A Virgin Among the Living Dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay? The reason I'd say that is that it's difficult to give you an entry point
mm-hmm.
that will give you a real taste of his work because there's so much variety in his filmography. Mm-hmm. Remember, this guy's made about 200 damn movies.
Yeah. And you definitely, I definitely understand Tim Lucas has pointed out before that he because of the way he returns to and re-explores themes over and over again, it's so hard to judge him by one film because
yeah.
even one type of film, it's like you almost need to see the next four or five he made of that same type again to really start to get an idea of, you know, of what he was trying to say or to take them almost like as a group of films, you know, and rather than just taking any one single film and kind of giving you everything.
Well, I was trying to remember, I was thinking about this the other day. I was trying to remember what film was it, what Jess Franco film was it that I finally watched that made me understand, wait a minute, of this type of movie, I think I finally found something that I can get behind. There's something mm-hmm. here that really drew me in. And more and more I look back at it, and there was a DVD release by Synapse Films here mm-hmm. in the States of his film, Exorcism, back in 2002 on DVD. Now, I picked it up because at that time I had started to see enough Franco films to realize, you know, a lot of people continue to talk about this guy as someone mm-hmm. to take seriously, and I've seen a few things that are actually kind of interesting at this point. I think I'd maybe already seen Awful Dr. Orloff, which
right.
isn't this type of movie.
Yeah.
But I picked this up because I trust Synapse,
mm-hmm.
Don May Jr.'s company, to put out a quality product, and if he's going to spend some time on this, I should pay attention.
Yeah.
Plus, I really loved the cover art for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked it up and watched this, and something clicked when I watched that film. I don't know exactly what it was, but I've rewatched the movie a couple of times, and it has a little more plot than a lot of the other films of this type that we're talking about that he made. But it had that feel kind of throughout it. It's got also one of my favorite completely ridiculous endings.
Oh, really?
Pretty much monster over movie, you know, monster dead movie over.
Uh-huh.
Only what's hysterical is it's like, you know, bad guy dead, cops grin, jump in the car and drive away. And it's like, don't you need to like draw a chalk outline around the dead body or maybe get the authorities
like,
in here?
I would just let the buzzards take care of it.
But,
you know, it's just
at that, you know, while you're watching the film, it actually kind of works, which
yeah.
is nice.
Yeah.
Then Synapse put out the film, his film, kind of a similar film called She Killed in Ecstasy, which introduced me to his... It's another one. Like I say, almost plotless. It takes a long while before you realize why the main character, played by the beautiful Soledad Miranda, why she's so melancholy. And then once you do, you understand what she's doing in the film, and you understand that she is enacting a kind of revenge fantasy against people for a certain... the death of a certain person. Interesting film. Like I say, not a good entry point for these types of films, but I really enjoy it. So, after that, I was able to see what people were seeing and talking about with these types of Franco films. They are not for the faint of heart. They are not for the easily bored. They're not for the... honestly, they're for the cinephile. They're for the person who loves movies and who enjoys something different, something that is a little challenging at times, and that it's, and at some points are going to just confuse you as to just what in the hell am I looking at here? And why is this filmed the way it is? Very much like A Virgin Among the Living Dead, except Virgin Among the Living Dead doesn't have very many of those moments like some of his other ones. This one is so tightly refined that it is a dreamlike, trance-like movie at times. But I never get bored with it.
I was going to say, I think there's only one scene in the whole film, and even it's not too tough to watch because the other blonde actress, not the main actress, but the
oh,
one
Brett
who's
Nichols?
There. Yeah, who's basically riding on the floor in her red 90. And
that goes on a bit
That
long.
Scene's like, okay, it's like as nice as it is, where it goes, where Howard Vernon's playing the piano and she's doing this weird interaction with Jess Franco himself, who was very commonly, we should mention that, is he very commonly put himself in films, normally playing the really weird, like this type character that he plays in this film. It seems to me like that's very often what he casts himself as.
I know, he's in it as one of the, I guess, a member of Christina's extended family that she meets. But he's not really a member of the family. He's kind of like a servant or retainer, and he's a mute, and he really plays the character as kind of a vacant-eyed mental deficient. It's a very odd thing. He speaks in grunts and just basic sounds. He looks like he's been clubbed in the head and can't really get his thoughts together most of the time.
And like I said, you've seen a lot more of his films than me, but I think that's generally, he can cast himself very often in those kind of secondary, almost like sort of, I guess,
well,
henchmen
always,
or kind of
always.
Roles or sort of like
he
just
plays
sort of a secondary.
A,
I don't know
in Exorcism, that film I was telling you about earlier, in his film Exorcism, which I know is now confusing considering we've covered Paul Nash's movie with the same title. I know. But in that movie, Franco himself plays, I guess, what you would refer to as kind of the main villain, although it's not really a, it's kind of a villainous role. So he doesn't always play a kind of mute idiot, but in this film he certainly does.
Now, what's the film where he, where the, I saw it listed in there, and I don't know what the title I saw it under, I don't, it, because I saw it again on an American videotape release, and I think it was, as I understand it, very, very badly cut. But the Jack the Ripper one he did. I know
just called Jack the Ripper in general.
Okay, I can't remember. I saw it. You like that one? Okay, because once again, I saw it, and I think it was a very bad English cut.
Well, if you can get a good version of that film, I think that's a pretty good entry point for a Franco person, because...
But I remember he has a pretty major role in that. Or did he play the...
It was Klaus Kinski who played the Ripper character.
Okay.
And Klaus Kinski is, of course, always a draw, no matter what.
That's fascinating to watch. Yeah.
The film, it was 1976. Actually, he had a budget for that thing. And I forget where it was filmed, but nobody's ever going to be fooled that it was filmed anywhere near London. And nobody's ever going to be fooled that the story they're telling has any real relation to the Jack the Ripper murders by any stretch of the imagination. You can know very little about the Jack the Ripper murders and know this shit doesn't fit this thing at all. But that film is actually pretty damn entertaining.
Yeah, I need to see the full version of it. Maybe he had another role in the film, or maybe I just almost feel like I remember him being in the film somewhere, but maybe
remember.
Not.
He may have been in Jack the Ripper, but I can't.
But you're right, and this, you know, but getting back to Virgin Among the Living Dead, I really think that this one scene that we were referring to here is maybe the only time in the whole movie that a scene just kind of went on a little too, where he's kind of like, okay, let's move it on. And otherwise, I mean, it really held me. I thought that it did a great job of, and it's not easy to do that in a film like this, is I think tonally it really just stays on course.
Even though it is
kind of a meandering, dreamlike film, and I feel like it really holds together tone-wise, you know, through the whole film. I think it doesn't stray far from the path.
Wait a minute. You brought up Britt Nichols. the blonde actress, very attractive woman who, as far as I can tell, really had a very short film career.
Yeah, I think I looked up too, and really didn't do
most
much.
Of the films that she made. She actually were Jess Franco movies. Mm-hmm. She had apparently an uncredited role in Tombs of the Blind Dead as one of the maidens who gets sacrificed.
Oh, okay.
But to be honest, I would have to go back and look very carefully to know for sure. But she was in Dracula, Prisoner of Frankenstein, which is one of Franco's films, and Lovers of Devil Island, and The Demons, and essentially almost everything she was in was a Franco film.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful young woman.
She was.
Very attractive and very neat to see, but I don't know that we, especially from this film, I don't know that we really get a sense of whether she was a good actress or not.
Yes.
Apparently she was Portuguese.
Hmm.
And since he was filming a good deal. This film was made in Portugal, so that may have something to do with her casting in the role or her casting of several films that he made around this same period of time from 72 to about 74. It was really when her career exists at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it just may have been right place, right time for her to have a little mini career with this one particular filmmaker.
Yeah.
Interesting woman, but I would like to point out that my favorite actor in the entire film is the always dependable Howard Vernon.
Well, he's awesome in this.
And I love the fact that he plays a character named Uncle Howard.
He does.
It's like, we're not even going to get away from his name. We're just going to call him Uncle Howard.
Oh, and he's great. He's such a hipster in this with his shirt, man. His shirt is so awesome, you know. And he's
dude, if you could dress like Howard Vernon in this movie, you would just be the most laid-back, casual, cool guy.
He is. And sitting there playing the piano with that constant cigarette.
Oh,
he's just cool as hell, man.
And I don't know if Howard...
I know he didn't get to play that kind of role a whole lot. He's just like, he's living it up.
He smiles all the time in this movie. He's having
fun. He has a lot of fun. In this film. So,
I love him in this movie.
Yeah.
Of course, he's the original Dr. Orloff from 62.
That's true.
You can't go wrong with Howard Vernon.
And for NashyCast listeners, we last saw him in Howl of the Devil.
Exactly. Gotta love Howard Vernon. The man can be counted upon. Mm-hmm. He was a consummate professional. There may be stories out there where people have bad things to say about him, but I can't find any of them.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating to find out. I've seen him in so many Franco films. He worked with him so often, just in so many movies, playing so many different roles. But the joy for me is I love watching a lot of different movies and seeing him crop up in things that I have no idea he's going to be in.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, when a DVD finally came out of Fritz Lang's film The Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse, and Howard Vernon's in that as an assassin.
Oh, cool.
And he's so cool. But then what's great is to reading the book about Fritz Lang's life and finding out that while making that film, Lang and Vernon became really good friends,
cool.
Which really freaked everybody out because Howard Vernon was an openly gay man, which I did not know until I actually was reading this book about Fritz Lang. And Fritz Lang was a homophobe. Really did not like homosexuals and always had trouble with them throughout his life. Was really paranoid about them until he met Howard Vernon and just really liked Howard a lot.
Cool.
And they remained really close friends. And apparently everybody was shocked by this. It was just like he and Howard Vernon were just like really close. They were really friendly from there on.
Wow, that's cool.
So very interesting. Of course, Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse is a great film, and it is so wild for me to occasionally spot Howard Vernon pop up in somebody else's movie because I'm just used to him being kind of
the road company of Franco.
I mean he pops up in Alphaville for God's sake, and he's got a role in the classic film The Train, the Burt Lancaster film from 64. So he's all over the place, and he made a lot of different kinds of films, but I just always associate him with Franco. But he's so good in this. And I got to tell you this. I don't know if Howard played the piano, but he fakes playing the piano.
He fakes it very well.
Really well.
If he's not playing it, you're right. He's very convincing.
Yeah.
You know, very convincing at that. So, so essentially, the film basically is Christina meeting her relatives, waiting around to get the will read from her father. Things just getting progressively, her... not just losing more and more grounding on what's real and what's not, what's
going
on.
She keeps having these bizarre things happen to her, but then she's not sure if they were nightmares.
Right. She has visions of her dead father. There's sort of this dark Queen of Death, you know, that's
queen,
sort
the,
of
the Queen of the
Darkness,
night.
Queen of the Night, or whatever.
Played by the, and I know I'm starting to sound like a broken record here, but played by the extraordinarily attractive Anne Liebert.
Yes, yes.
What a beautiful woman.
Yes, yes. She could be the queen of my night anytime.
Another one of those ladies who I know primarily through Franco films. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, striking, dark-haired woman.
Yeah.
She was in this, Diary of a Nymphomaniac, Lovers of Devil's Islands, quite a few other films. Mm-hmm. She was in O in 74, which wouldn't surprise me considering the general synopsis of that film storyline. Mm-hmm. But she seems to have had a career up until about 79 or 81 and then kind of dropped out of sight.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she has a single line of dialogue in this movie. She's just kind of there as gorgeous face.
And other characters refer to her. Sometimes they speak about her.
Well, now let's talk about something. I'll probably want to get back to a couple of other cast members eventually. But let's talk about something that is fairly off-putting to a lot of people when you start going into just Franco films.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the zoom lens.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was wanting to say that, too.
Okay, well, the zoom lens is a crime against cinema in general. Not because the zoom lens exists, but because sometimes a filmmaker will overuse it or use it in a way that immediately just jerks you right out of the fact that you're watching a film. It makes you realize that you're looking at something artificial and it kind of blows it for you. Now, I'm not going to say that there aren't moments in A Virgin Among the Living Dead, and maybe I should explain what I'm talking about. When we talk about the zoom lens, we're talking about a sequence in a film where you will be watching either a wide shot or a tight shot of something, and then the camera will zoom out or in, depending on where it starts, to show you something else. Now, this can be done for certain effects, but in general, the reason the zoom lens was used, especially in the 70s, 60s and 70s, I would say, is that it is a cheap way to not have to do extra camera setups, which can be very time-consuming when you're making a movie. It's very expensive.
Right.
It's a cheap way to get more than one look at a scene without another camera setup. You just keep rolling film, the actors keep going, and you zoom in and out of the image to give you a look at whatever you want to draw attention to. Can be irritating as hell. Can really piss you off at times, because sometimes you can get whipped around so often with a zoom lens that you start to get a headache. Franco uses the zoom lens like a gunfighter uses a six gun sometimes, which is that he'll sling that son of a bitch around to the point where you're wondering if he has any idea what the hell he should be focusing on. In this movie, he uses it a number of times. And sometimes, I will say, it draws attention to itself in a bad way, but not too badly. Now, we've both seen enough Franco films where the zoom lens gets used to zoom in on a boat out in the harbor and then zoom back out to show you the entire bay, and you're just sitting there going, holy shit, that was unnecessary.
Yeah, and I tell you, and this is not something that, you know, you could expect Jess Franco to have anticipated or to thought of himself or to have cared about, but while using the zoom lens, but God help you if you see these things in a pan and scan version, which is how I first saw them. And boy, if you think the zoom lens gets annoying or gets distracting in a widescreen when you're seeing it in the frame it was supposed to, then just try it on a pan and scan. Is boy, does it really, really jolt you. But the thing is I was glad you brought it up, because I was bringing up too that of course, obviously, when I saw this film on TV and it was, you know, cropped, just as I saw Count Dracula on TV when it was cropped like that, and I found the zoom to just be incredibly annoying, and I really felt seeing this film framed the way it's supposed to be framed, it's much less intrusive, because even when it, the film, even when, now, you know, does he overuse it? Yes, of course, it's Jess Franco. He uses it, he does overuse it, but the framing is always good, and that's what makes the difference, is that
I agree.
When it zooms in, the framing is always on the faces, and there are some amazing faces in this film, you know, it's very distinctive faces, and you know, it's always, the framing is always very, still very well done, and that makes it easier to take, you know, and it's going to be interesting to me when we go around to watch Count Dracula, because Count Dracula, I think, is actually, I want to say, I haven't looked at it yet, but I think it's I'm assuming that DVD is correctly framed at whatever it was, it was filmed at.
But it's correctly framed, but it's framed at 1.33.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting to see how it affects me in that, because, again, that's another one I remember trying to watch on TV and just like, boy, the zoom is just like, okay.
Yeah, the zooming in Count Dracula will be a different matter.
Yes.
You wouldn't have been seeing it cropped, I don't think, but... Mm-hmm. Count Dracula has problems of its own.
Yeah, we'll get to those.
We'll get to those.
But yes, I was pleased that the zoom did not bother me near as badly in Virgin Among the Living Dead. It was much easier to take.
Didn't bother you? Didn't take you out of it?
No, it's in fact, well, only distracted me to the sense of noticing how much better it came off than what I was used to in Franco films, and just thinking about how that is something that people always point to. It's kind of the running joke with, you know, whoever's watching it is always, you know, master of the zoom lens, or maybe not master of it, but overuser of the zoom lens. But I really found it worked pretty good in this.
Just the other night, I rewatched the first about 20 minutes. Just last night, I just rewatched the first 20 minutes of Mario Bava's Barren Blood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Barren Blood is not a film that I've held in high esteem. I've never hated the film. I just always think it's one of Bava's lesser movies, mm-hmm. because it's a fairly simple movie. It's set in contemporary times. I've always looked a little bit down on it. Mm-hmm. But the first 20 minutes of it I watched last night, and I was thinking, I may have to reevaluate this film. I'm really grooving on the mood of this thing. And the thing is, in that one, there are a number of times, in just the first 20 minutes, where Bava uses the zoom lens.
Mm-hmm.
And what's wild is that he uses it very effectively.
Mm-hmm.
He used it to zoom in on a door that somebody's knocking
mm-hmm.
on.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to just immediately go, whoosh, and he matches the zoom with that sound.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, using the zoom artistically, which is... not something that I can often say I feel is happening in a Franco film.
Yeah.
Now, but in this case, mm-hmm. there were a couple of times when I think he really did use the zoom lens in this film artistically. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think it was just a way to get away without having to go through the trouble of setting up the camera for a second shot.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene that I'll reference where he overuses the zoom lens, but... because, as you were talking about, he chose his shots carefully and framed them well,
mm-hmm.
it comes off really well. And it's the sequence I would just refer to as kind of the water nymph amongst the lily pads.
Right, yeah.
Which is that wonderful scene where mm-hmm. Christina goes out, is just walking around the valley, walking around mm-hmm. the lands, and she comes upon this this little lake or pond. And it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. This whole area where they filmed this movie is a physically gorgeous place, just beautiful, very fecund, overgrown with lush trees and bushes and flowers, and all this kind of stuff. And you see this pond, and most of the surface is covered in lily pads. It's just absolutely, it's bucolic. It's wonderful. And she undresses, and goes swimming in the pond.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts out, you know, wide shot, and then comes in on her as she undresses, and then pulls back out as she goes into the water.
Yeah.
And it really is an abuse of the zoom lens.
Yeah.
He should have set that up a little differently. But to be honest, in this sequence, mm-hmm. you're essentially watching this happen: her come up, mm-hmm. decide to go swimming, undress, mm-hmm. and get into the water and swim, all kind of in real time.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't feel strained. It didn't feel rough.
Yeah.
It didn't feel cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a couple of points in the film where the zoom lens did feel cheap,
mm-hmm.
but not there. And I think it's probably because he had such a beautiful tableau to film, naturally gorgeous spot to film this. He took his time, chose his shots, thought it out in advance, mm-hmm. and instead of taking the time to set up the camera again and get a different angle on it.
Yeah.
He chose his angle and then shot it beautifully.
I agree. And I'm also going to... it's also this scene I'm going to use to support my campaign to bring back terry cloth shorts for women.
Oh, good point.
Yeah. Miss those from the 70s.
I remember I had a great pair of blue terry cloth shorts when I was a kid. and I can remember the day I had to get rid of them, which is when I got shot with a BB gun along the leg, and it tore a groove in the side, in the left side of the shorts, and it was the end of those. Yeah, don't ask why someone was shooting at me with a BB gun.
I was about to say, I don't even want to end.
I think it was my brother, actually. We were probably shooting at each other with BB guns, which is, I don't recommend, kids. Don't ever do that. You know, put your eye out. You seriously will. Terry cloth shorts. I hadn't thought about that in a long while. That didn't even register on my mind. Oh Lord. Well, let's take a little break. Have a bit of the French dialogue from the film here. Mm. Just a brief bit of dialogue here for those of you who can understand French. Mm. Here's a sad fact. I took 2 or 3 years of French in high school and college.
Yeah.
Enough French that. When I went to Paris and northern France when I was a senior in high school, I actually was able to communicate pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Not great. I wasn't anywhere close to fluent, but I was actually able to communicate well enough to get around in France and mm-hmm. carry on some franglais conversations, half English, half French, with a number of Parisians. But man, now it's so much of it's gone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But one of the neat things about watching this film with the French track on was, as you read the subtitles and listen, occasionally I could tell, ooh, that's not quite exactly what they're saying.
Really?
I would have translated that. Yeah. I mean, because that word isn't exactly what they're translating.
Oh, yeah.
But I would say the English subtitles on this image DVD, very effective, and it's nice that it kind of keeps a bit of the poetry.
It does. There's some really great lines of dialogue in there, and I thought so too, yeah.
But we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back in a minute.
Voilà une heure que nous roulons vers le fond de la vallée. Et j'ai l'impression de vivre un rêve étrange. Le chant des oiseaux ne m'est plus aussi familier. Il me semble que j'aperçois des oiseaux de proie. Des oiseaux de proie. Mais voyons, c'est impossible. Au fond d'une vallée, des plantes qui respirent la vie. Et pourtant, quelle couleur bizarre, quel parfum troublant, inconnu. Où sommes-nous donc? Quel est cet univers ouaté d'ombre et de silence? Triste comme un cimetière par un matin d'automne.
All right, for those of you who can't speak French, too bad. No, there's no way to provide subtitles over the... Anyway, a few more things I'd like to talk about with the film is there's this great scene. It's right after the swimming in the lily pad scene where some of the locals see her swimming in the pond.
Right.
And there's two guys who are kind of, you know, ogling her and mm-hmm. talking dirty about her as they're
basically
watch
like if you and I were watching her. It's about to be this. They're like older versions of you and me, basically.
Going, oh my God, look at her. Oh, Jesus. And they get, what's funny is they get run off by a younger guy mm-hmm. who kind of shames them and runs them off.
Yeah.
And then he sees her, and once she gets out of the mm-hmm. pond mm-hmm. and gets dressed again, he runs over to her to kind of apologize and explain himself and sees her, and of course it's Christina von Blank and she's gorgeous, so he starts talking to her and they start walking through the forest together, and they come upon this chapel there.
And again,
in the woods.
During their conversation, he's been throwing out the same thing too. It's like nobody lives at. There's nobody at the castle you're at. You know, she's talking about living in the castle, and he's like, "There's nobody there."
Yeah, she brushes it aside. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You walk back to the castle with me, and I'll introduce mm-hmm. you to my family.
Yeah.
So, they come to this chapel, out in the middle of nowhere, and there's this old man sitting out in front of it. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an old man sitting out in the front of it, and he explains that the chapel's closed up, or he'd be inside himself praying. Mm-hmm. And it's apparently a chapel to Saint Cecile. Mm-hmm. Now, did a little research. Saint Cecile is the patron saint of musicians and church music because she was dying. Huh. As she was dying, she sang to God.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
So she's the patroness of music, essentially, in the Catholic
Church. Nice research. I didn't know that. But this scene definitely stood out to me because the whole thing, every scene of that man is filmed in a way that nothing else in the film is filmed. It uses that lens that almost
kind
gives
it... fisheye.
Fisheye lens, and that's not used anywhere else in the film except when it shows this guy, when they're talking to this guy who's sitting outside. And I thought that was kind of an interesting touch, the interesting choice.
What another thing that's interesting about this is that, so essentially, Christina and this young man and this older man who's sitting there are refused entry to this chapel because it's closed up.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, here's what I began to wonder. As the film goes on, it becomes clear that she is seeing and talking and interacting with what amounts to ghosts in a lot of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so by this point in the film, I almost get the impression, having watched the movie more than once, of course, that she has been touched by the other world,
mm-hmm.
by death in a way, mm-hmm. but she's still alive. And it's almost her life force, her vivaciousness, that seems to attract these other people into the valley this time. Mm-hmm. The two guys, the two older guys who ogle her in the pond, mm-hmm. and this younger man, you seem to get the impression that normally they wouldn't even be in the area. And it's mm-hmm. almost as if her being alive in the valley almost attracts them there.
Mm-hmm.
And nice. But as she's kind of already touched by death or the dead, there's a certain distance between her and them. There's no interaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, she doesn't get any closer to this guy. There's just this one sequence with him.
Right.
He never comes back.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that might be some little thing there. That's just another little piece of evidence along the way as you begin to suspect, wow, you know, why do people keep saying this? Why is this mm-hmm. why is yeah. this going on? It's really effective. I wondered when the sequence with the chapel, what did you see in that? Did you see anything that's out of out of the obvious in it?
Not really. I mean, what the scene just said to me was just, again, just kind of reemphasizing the fact that everything in the valley is dead, you know, that the fact that, I mean, he's come to this, or closed off to the world of the living. I mean, this guy's made this journey, he says, to see this chapel, but it's barred, you know, shut. It's like that's, you know, it's you know, it's kind of like that, to me, that's just kind of, to me, reinforced the idea of the whole area, that it being a valley of death, you know, a valley that's been closed off to the living.
Now, another thing I'd like to touch on is the character of her father, because she mm-hmm. she begins to have either dreams mm-hmm. or visions
yeah.
of her dead father, who she's only ever seen photographs of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her father's played by Franco regular Paul Mueller,
mm-hmm.
who's a heck of an actor. I always mm-hmm. love seeing him pop up in things, and he was in dozens upon dozens of Jess Franco, well, not dozens, but he was in a lot of mm-hmm. Jess Franco films, but he also turns up in a whole lot of other movies. I don't think we've covered any films yet that he's in, but we've definitely seen other films that he's been in. He'll turn up in Count Dracula for us here in a few weeks. He was in The Arena, the Pam Grier film, one of the few Pam Grier films from the early 70s that I still haven't seen, which mm-hmm. is just another reason to see that film, as if I needed another reason to see that film. But he was in Scorpion with Two Tails. Lots and lots of films. God, how many credits? He was in The Winds of War, the TV miniseries Winds of War.
Wow.
Holy crap, he's in everything. An endless list of, let's see, what has he got? 241 credits starting in 1948.
Wow.
So, I mean, he was in Nightmare Castle. He was in Lady Frankenstein, one of my favorite movies. He was just in a lot of movies. His last credit was in 2004.
My gosh.
Yeah, I mean, so...
Yeah.
Paul Mueller.
Yeah, hell of a career.
Mark him down. Check out his movies. He was well worth seeing in anything he was ever in. But he plays her father in this, and every time she has a vision of him, he has a noose around his neck, which apparently is how he died.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several scenes where she sees and speaks with her father, and one of them in particular is one of the most gorgeous, creepy moments I think Franco ever got on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we talked about this briefly before, where she's sitting and talking to him, and he's behind a desk, and there's just this amazing moment where, as they speak, he recedes into the shadows and slowly disappears, which is anybody. And you will find people who are willing to say that Jess Franco is an incompetent filmmaker, is a hack, who's terrible. And I'll say that there are plenty of things to point to mm-hmm. back up that argument.
Yeah.
But I don't think anybody could see this sequence in this film and not know mm-hmm. they weren't dealing with somebody who knew how to make mm-hmm. movies.
Yeah.
This is it's a great scene from its mood and atmosphere alone. Its effect, the dialogue between the two characters, as she's desperately attempting to speak mm-hmm. to her father, who mm-hmm. she never got to know.
Yeah.
And then the end of the scene, which is just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It may be the most effective thing in the movie.
And I really love the... I agree with you about that scene, and I also love the scene of her seeing him hanging from the trees and him floating back. She's walking on the path, and she sees him hanging just there in the middle of the path, and he just, as she's walking towards him, he's leading her. His body is basically floating through the trees, hanging. Yeah. I mean, that's just a simply filmed scene that's very effective. It's just a very, very neat image there.
It's beautiful, too, because as that scene goes on and the dialogue goes on, as it's almost as if that movement is a way to keep the same distance between them, as if she'll never be able to touch him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. is just a neat little visual statement of mm-hmm. the fact that he's dead and she never will be able to. It's mm-hmm. it's really neat, and there's a lot of things like that in the movie.
You can also read this film as very subtly as a vampire film, too, and that's another thing that makes it kind of interesting, It's like we've been talking in terms of ghost, but there's little hints of vampirism in there, too, but never overdone,
Well,
never,
with the sequence that stands out, of course, is the Brick Nichols scene where Christina stumbles upon her in a room with another woman, and it looks as if it's some kind of lesbian sex mm-hmm. act, mm-hmm. but it certainly involves using a pair of scissors to gouge... to gouge mm-hmm. wounds into the mm-hmm. other woman's breasts to mm-hmm. drink blood from them. Yeah. So,
and there's the bats that she sees on her bed. Just the whole Queen of Darkness character, could very much be seen as a sort of vampire's character. But again, it's all done very, just another way to read the film. And
well, that's one of the great things about this movie, is that with this type of Franco film, the overwhelming mood is kind of one of melancholy.
Yeah, it is.
Almost a detached ennui, a feeling of being mm-hmm. of kind of floating above the deeper, sharper emotions that you would normally have, and observing them from above or from a distance, dreamlike effect that allows mm-hmm. you to look upon these incredibly emotional things and observe without being part of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. The thing about this is that I think one of the things he was constantly striving for in these types of films was a kind of morbid poetry. Poetry about death, but death being a poetic thing, something that needed to be approached mm-hmm. to be understood, needed to be mm-hmm. approached as something best understood by a poet, by an artist, by mm-hmm. someone who was creative enough to find a way to view it mm-hmm. that would allow you to make it a part of you so that it wouldn't destroy you.
Yeah.
And since what we're dealing with here is a woman who never met her father,
right,
and now he's gone, he's mm-hmm. dead, and you can read a lot of this movie as her constantly trying to find a way to have some kind of connection, to finally actually speak to her father in this place where he lived, in this place where he spent most of his life and that she was excluded from until he was gone. This is it's a beautiful thing, and like I say, it's poetic. We talk about the atmosphere of the film mm-hmm. and the mood of it.
Yeah.
It's all there. It's played to be one could almost, if it wasn't for the nudity and the oddness and the strange sexual overtones and the strange eroticism, one might call this film pretentious. Hell, I'm sure some people have referred to it as pretentious.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the great things about this type of Franco film is that he revels in the exploitive elements of what he's presenting, but in a way that, in the best of them, enhances the quote-unquote pretentious nature of some of the ideas that he's attempting to present. So one almost feeds the other.
Yeah.
The exploitive elements feed the kind of arch, higher ideas that he's playing with. The search for a connection to a family you never had. The look at relationships in a family that you wish were closer. Things of that nature that are very clear and they're very much there without someone underlining with a bombastic score or obvious dialogue.
And he's able to throw in a little bit of humor here too, and just a couple little things there that are actually very obviously meant to be funny and I think work pretty well. I mean, the Jess Franco character snoring through the whole reading of the will scene to me is very funny, because I think Franco's in a way saying, okay, how many times has this scene, you know, we have to do this, but how many times has this scene been in movies? You know, the reading of the will scene. It's just never going to be exciting no matter how much you can. So the fact that he has his character snore through the whole scene is, I thought, was very funny, actually. I thought that was pretty good.
One of the funnier scenes in it for me was when at one point Christina has passed out and she wakes up and there's this character that we assume is a doctor
and
who's taking her temperature, and he takes the thermometer out of her mouth and looks at it and goes, "She's delirious."
It's like
you got that from
the thermometer? Okay, Doc. Exactly. It's like, yeah, I thought about that too. Well, yeah, and his whole manner, his whole expressions are just very obviously supposed to be just a completely insane over the top.
Oh, I know. Character, very scary.
Yeah, I love that. Looking at the thermometer. She's delirious.
Well, not only that.
Does there look a little reading that says crazy on the thermometer?
Yeah, I know. Did she have the correct temperature for crazy?
Crazy.
Oh, my God. The spooky, melancholy mood is broken up occasionally by things like that. You're right. And one of those moments is that bizarre scene where she wakes up and there's this black dildo on the floor.
Yeah, that's
pointing upward, sitting there. I mean, it's obviously a black cock and balls, a dildo. I mean,
the whole way the scene ends up is great, because it does this really slow, you know, where she wakes up and looks and gradually, obviously, is terrorized by something she sees in the room. And you don't know what it is, and it takes forever for she finally to give us the wide shot where it's just this big black dildo in the middle of the floor.
And then in the dialogue, I forget who she's talking to.
Well, it's the blonde girl that's in there.
Oh, that's right. She refers to it as the great phallus.
Well, it's, you know, she slaps. Yeah, she slowly creeps up on the, you know, Christina slowly approaches the phallus, and then, you know, knocks it out of the way and smashes it. And then the blonde girl's like, "Oh, you really screwed up. That was the great phallus." The great, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, if I wake up and there's a black dildo in the middle of the room, I'm going to smash it too. You know?
I'll put a box over it and make sure nobody's seen this and think, well, I'm some kind of freak.
Yeah, I mean, but I can only
think. That was a giant thing.
I mean, it's like, I can only think that that is not, I mean, you can't accuse that scene of being pretentious in any way.
No,
I mean, that can only be just Franco just fucking with everybody, really. It's just,
Well, no, but I will say this. One last element I'd like to talk about is the way the film treats time.
Mm-hmm.
When she arrives at the castle, there's a great big clock on the outside of the castle, one of the towers, and very pointedly on the soundtrack, you hear the ticking of a clock, as if we've now entered this valley, we're at the castle, and therefore I want you to pay attention to time because it starts to move differently.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a different place and time here. And then that happens again later in the film as well, as different things start to happen.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful moment late in the film where the character that Franco himself plays reaches up to this grandfather clock there in one of the rooms of the castle and bends the clock, the hands on the clock, bends them out of shape as if to totally disrupt timekeeping, to point out, time doesn't really function here. Time is not something that needs to be measured in this place.
Because, again, like I said, once the film really works on kind of one big loop that has smaller loops within it, and I think that there's probably, and you could probably argue about which point it is, but I think that there's probably a point in the film you could say, from this moment on, time really has stopped, and she's basically just, you know, keeps going back to the same point again, keeps reawaking, thinking that she's been, you know, in a dream, and begins another nightmare dream, you know, that it just keeps looping around and time really has stopped. So it's a good point about where the scene where he literally physically reaches up and just grabs the clock and stops it, you know.
Yeah. a fascinating film, one that
it really is.
I'm always happy to return to, because I think each time I see it, I see a little bit more, something a little different. And I think that in a way, it's one of those films that as you get older, I think you can catch different things depending on where you are in your life.
Yeah.
If you're in a happy place in your life, or if you're in a sad place, if you're at different ages even.
Mm.
I think this film is one of those. I wouldn't call it necessarily an ink blot or a Rorschach test of some type, but it definitely has enough in it that allows you to project. Well, there's that old phrase that with almost any piece of art, and film most especially, what you bring to it reflects a lot of what you will get out of it.
Yeah.
If what you bring to something are certain preconceived notions or certain ideas about what you want it to be, you may or may not get what the filmmaker intended out of it.
Yeah. And the thing is that doesn't still mean it's not there, even if the filmmaker himself wasn't thinking or intending to put it in there. It's once he's made the film, it's out there for all of us to...
Oh, exactly.
All of us to bring our own thing to it, which doesn't... So even if we see something in it that he never thought of, it doesn't mean it's, you know, doesn't mean it's not legitimately there, you know, doesn't mean it's...
Well, here's another thing to toss out. One of the things that a lot of Franco fans or Franco aficionados have tossed out is the idea that in a lot of ways, these types of Franco films especially are kind of like music or jazz in a way, jazz music especially.
We know how much that influenced him, how big
he was a jazz musician, or still is, I guess, to a degree. And we've already talked about how, like a musician, he returned to this type of film, this type of story, this type of idea, again and again throughout his career, like a musician working over a particular melody, trying to find something new in it, trying to find a way to bring something new to it, or find some new end to it that will allow him to break it open and find something fresh. And this film really does strike me as a glorious piece of film / music, and the score, of course, marries perfectly with it.
Yeah.
I can't think of the film without hearing the score most of the time.
Right.
And to that degree, I think that's why I find it the most effective of this type of Franco film that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It is a lot like music. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call this one a jazz.
No.
A piece of jazz. I would call this one... Well, maybe you said it earlier, pastoral, a pastoral piece.
Yeah.
Slightly melancholy, kind of sad at times. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing, but it bears repeat viewings, much like a great piece of music, it bears repeat listens.
Yeah, well, I thoroughly enjoyed watching it a couple of times through. I can definitely see myself watching it again. I think I would have to go back to, you know, I'd probably have to rewatch the Franco films that I have enjoyed to say this for sure. But right now, I feel like it may be my favorite of the Franco films I've seen. You know, acknowledging that I still have miles and miles to go.
Oh, wow.
But it's, you know, but even though there are definitely others I've very much enjoyed, I feel like this one may be my favorite of what I've seen so far. And I can't wait to call my friend Larry and say, "You remember that film years ago? It's a good film." He'll be like, "What are you smoking?" And
yeah, really.
I was like, "No, I promise you that crazy zombie film that just kept repeating itself over and over again. It's a good movie.
You need to see the actual film itself.
Yeah,
not what the hell we saw." All right. Well, I guess we'll take a quick break. Come back, read a few emails, and get out of here, folks.
Sounds good.
Are we forgetting anything? I don't think we are. All right. Well, folks, we'll be back in a few minutes and read your emails.
Cynthia, so glad you're home. I have some very exciting news.
Well, I have some news for you too, Jonathan.
Me first. I've just discovered a great podcast called Mail Order Zombie, and it's hosted by a married couple just like us.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I had a meeting with the lawyer today and...
It's mainly about direct-to-DVD zombie movies, but the show covers the whole range of zombie culture. Games, books, plays, comics, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I've been spending a lot of time with my massage therapist, Rodrigo.
Is he into post-apocalyptic novels, films, and TV shows? Because if he is, you should let him know that those things are all covered on Mail Order Zombie 2.
I have taken the liberty of putting your belongings in these garbage bags over here.
Hope you remember to pack my MP3 player, because I'd sure hate to miss the next episode of Mail Order Zombie. You can find it online at mailorderzombie.com, or just look for Mail Order Zombie in the iTunes store, and it's all free!
Yes, free! Like I hope to be very soon.
So what is it you wanted to say to me, Cynthia?
You're an idiot.
Oh, I love you too.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly. Speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
All right, folks, so before we get to reading some of your emails, we want to remind you that you can send your emails to nashycast@gmail.com. We very much appreciate getting them. We very much enjoy reading them. Remember, if there's anything you don't want shared over the air, to let us know. We also have a Facebook page, so please come to our Facebook page and check out updates there.
Like us.
Like us.
That always sounds so needy.
I know, we do.
Something else I'd like to toss out is if you listen to...
We are sad clowns.
We are sad.
With broken toys.
What was it? Oh, God, that great line by Jack.
We have shame for tea. That's
what
I loved.
I can't remember the line. It was that hysterical Algernon Lotus poem he wrote. Oh, God. Broken toy. What was
sad
it?
Sad clowns and broken toys is what I remember.
Sad clowns dancing across a field of broken toys or something like that. Oh,
this
God.
Is a dear departed friend of ours that would occasionally write poetry under the name of Algernon Lotus just to crack us up.
Hyper pretentious. The idea was that Algernon Lotus was this insanely pretentious British poet who was hailed as a genius at the ripe age of 8, and therefore wrote nothing but insanely pretentious crap forever. And so he would occasionally toss one of these things out, and oh God, man, some of that stuff, some of the images he would come up with.
We'll have shame for tea is just the one that I just love.
Oh no, that was the whole poem about the young man discovering that his mother is having sex with the servants. Oh God, jeez, that was the funniest shit. Oh God. Anyway. Okay,
yeah, so send us an email and we'll read you an Algernon Lotus poem sometime.
I'd have to dig them back out.
And come to our Facebook page, and now Rod is going to
thing. I put out a brief thing on Facebook saying that if you get the podcast, if you get the NashyCast through iTunes, and you can spare the time, write us a review on the iTunes in iTunes at the iTunes store. Just anything brief, you know, give us a 5-star review, 4-star review, whatever you
want.
10 stars if they had them. But, you know, any brief review, anything that, anything like that actually gets us a little bit more notice and gets a few more people who might not even know about the podcast to give it a look. Yeah. So that would help us out. That would be awful sweet of you.
Yeah. We'll send you a replica of the Grand Phallist if you do that for
us. No, we will not. We will not send you a, no. No, thank you. No. Well, Troy, you might want to. I don't know.
No. Well,
I'm not going down the plaster caster route.
I was
going
to say, let me get
thoughts,
the plaster ready.
I'm heading away from that thought process. But, okay, emails. We got a couple of emails here. I love this one. This is from Brad, and he titled this email, "The Exorcism of Tim Lucas." Gotta like that.
Yeah.
He says, "Hey, fellas, thought I would send you a couple of thoughts. I really enjoyed the Tim Lucas interview. It definitely gave me some things to ponder over. His championing, I can't even say it anymore.
That is championing, a tough word. Why is that a tough word?
I don't know. It's
championing,
of Count Dracula's great love is exactly the sort of thing that you want in these types of discussions. A nice divergence from the conventional wisdom. On Dracula, I fall between the two viewpoints. In fact, I rewatched it after listening to the episode with Tim's opinion in mind, and I can see how he would enjoy it so much despite the insane voiceover and the feeling that it is very much two halves put together. My wife loves it. I put Dracula in the middle of the Nashy canon, as it has some nice imagery, and Nashy as Dracula isn't as ridiculous as some folks seem to think. I was also surprised that he didn't think as much of Werewolf Shadow as most do. When I am turning someone onto Nashy, that and Horror Rises are always what I go to. I look forward to more Tim Lucas interviews and discussions. Rod did a great job, and hopefully Troy won't be besieged by groupies next time." Or was it hippies that mobbed him?
You know, in the dark, sometimes it's really sort of hard to tell.
All cats are black in the dark. Don't ever apologize for a long podcast. By the way, thank you, Brad, for saying
yes,
that.
Yes, thanks for saying that, Brad.
It's more time to really get into a film and get both of your opinions. I've been listening to B-Movie Cast's back episodes lately. I heard a voicemail from Rod. Well, Yeah, I've done a few voicemails for the B-Movie cast. Mm-hmm. He says, and I realized the other day that the show seems to me to be about friendship, with the films being a vehicle for that. I mean, they do a great job with the films, but they also have a built-in community. And I feel that way about NashyCast, too. Outside of really delving into the works of Paul Nashy, it always sounds like two friends talking. As everyone knows, you guys have great chemistry, and anytime Troy pokes at Rod over the Blind Dead films, or Rod works in something about Planet of the Apes, I smile. So bring on 3-hour episodes. I can't imagine anyone minding at all. Keep up the great work, gentlemen. Now, if you'll excuse me, the exorcism episode is calling.
Cool. Well, thank you, Brad. It's not just great chemistry we have, it's great chemitrudes.
Chemitrudes.
We have.
We're besieged by chemitrudes and hippies and groupies. So.
A couple of things I want to address right there real quick. Yes, thank you for saying that it's okay to go 3 hours, because we, being raised Southern boys, we're raised not to overstay our welcome. We're not like those rude Yankees that'll just chat away on their podcast for 6 hours or so, you know. So we feel a little, we're always like, Jesus, God, we talked forever on that. So,
yeah.
So hopefully that is, you know, we've not had any complaints so far. Hopefully everybody's okay with the fact that we're tending to push these things longer and longer as we go. Another thing, too, is, yeah, the podcast, you know, it's not about profit. It is about friendship, you know, and we've met some great friends through this. And I don't want to mention, take this point to mention our good friend Dan, our man in the field, as we talk about. Everybody knows Dan from listening to our show here. Dan lost his mother this week as we're recording this. So I just want to send our condolences to Dan, because we do feel like Dan is part of our family now that we've met through this podcast. And we very much appreciate him and all of you friends that we've made through doing this.
Anytime people come together over things that they're really passionate about, it's amazing how quickly friendships grow. It's amazing how much fun it is to get to know people. And I think it's always amazing the things that will draw people together, and how inconsequential the differences seem once you get into a community like that, and once you find those common interests and those things that draw you to each other, it's just an amazing thing. And I'm glad people are enjoying the show. We always hope people will enjoy what we're doing, but it's nice to know that the things that we worry sometimes about being off-putting are not necessarily off-putting. My occasional descent into babble about Planet of the Apes films or something like that. It could definitely be seen as somewhat outside the realm of a podcast about the films of Paul Nashy. So thank you very much, Brad. Always good to hear from you, and always great to know that there are people out there really paying attention and really enjoying this. I love the fact that listening to Tim talk about Count Dracula's Great Love sent him back to the movie to look at it again.
That's what it's all about. It's great.
It's great. I love that kind of thing. And, of course, we did get a new note from our beloved
Elena,
she of Madrid. She obviously listened to the exorcism episode and had a few notes for us. She said, we did a great job as ever, just a couple of things. She said, seatbelts started to be compulsory some years ago in Spain. And that was why in many movies, many of the older movies, they're not using them, which, you know, is pretty much the same here in the States, too. Yeah. I can't remember when they became compulsory.
I don't. I know we've been used to it for so long now. I have to admit, that first line there, when I read it, I was like, why is she telling us? Then I remembered she's referring to the car wreck at the first
car wreck and exorcism, where they were thrown clear.
Where they were thrown clear and unhurt, as everyone always is when they are thrown clear.
Of course, no one ever has their heads crushed by the car rolling over them. So lucky. She then says, Rod, you didn't win the debate. And of course, there she's referencing the debate that she and I had, along with David Z, on her show, Horror Rises from Spain, about the fourth Blind Dead film. And of course I wanted Elena. I won it because I had David Z on my side. You lost, my sweetums, you lost.
She just have to console herself with that Spain World Cup in this year, because
exactly. You got something to be proud of. Just, you know, you didn't win. I'm sorry. She says, Perez Guiner. I'm mispronouncing it, and I know she's laughing her ass off now because she made me mispronounce another damn Spanish name.
She did.
Perez Guiner, the one responsible for Pro Films, tells a story in The Man Who Saw Frankenstein Cry, the documentary about Paul Nashy.
Yes, and she's holding that over us, too, that she's seen it and
she's
we
seen
haven't.
It we haven't. He tells a story about Exorcism as it was released very close to The Exorcist at the same time when it came out. When people from the production companies went to Spanish towns to sell it, some people didn't buy the film because they thought it was the same movie. They thought they'd already bought it before. Yeah. So, makes sense. She references the Pure Terror cheapy Mill Creek pack that that Brian wrote in about, that we talked about in the last podcast. She says, I have the Pure Terror pack, and the Spanish horror films it contains are in very bad quality. I bought it because of the film My Mother is a Werewolf and a few others I wanted to watch, and it was very, very cheap. She said, I found it on a UK site with free shipping. And then she laughs at us. Hey, I can walk down to Walmart and pick it up for nothing. But yeah, the you know, it's a Mill Creek cheap pack. Yeah. It's not going to look good.
Yeah.
But
like I said, what was significant about it is the fact that, like we said, it actually mentions Paul Naschy on the cover as being a selling point, and that is something like we talked about we would not have seen a few years ago.
Definitely, definitely. Then she addresses me and she says, "You like all women, don't you?" And
can you deny it? Can you deny that there's
I can't
any...
say I like all women. Mm. I have said in the past that all women are beautiful. It just depends on how far away from them you have to be. Now, a lot of women, you have to be a fair distance off. Some women are beautiful right up close. But some, you know, some you have to be 10 feet away. Some you have to be 20 feet away. There are women you have to be a solid mile away before you think, oh, yeah, she's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I like all women. It's just that I want to give all women a fair shot.
I have to tell you, I was at the Wizard World Chicago convention this last weekend and stood face-to-face with Charisma Carpenter
from Buffy
the Vampire Slayer and Julie Benz from Buffy and Dexter. And those are the women that are beautiful on the level that's actually frightening because you realize that, you know, when you talk to them, when you're there in front of them standing face-to-face, you realize that they could make you tell them your bank routing number, your credit card number, your passwords are, and you wouldn't even realize that you were telling them because your brain is just melting from how stunning they are.
Those are two absolutely beautiful women. I assume they would be beautiful within just a few inches.
Believe me, but they were, and very, very sweet ladies too. Very, very, very friendly. But I can honestly say there are two cases where, believe it or not, I don't think the TV does them justice.
I've heard that about a few actresses, where in all honesty, although they photograph well, there's something quite different about actually being in their presence, and it's not a chemistry thing. It's just a matter of
there's something of their natural beauty that comes out there. Anyway, I won't forget that anytime soon.
To wrap it up, Elena says, I'll rewatch Vengeance of the Zombies and write more to you soon. About Jess Franco's, I have not seen the Virgin one. She's not seen Virgin Among the Living Dead, but I'll try to look for it. And about Count Dracula, it is boring as hell.
Elena has spoken.
She is calling us out Count Dracula. Yeah. Now, I have words about Dracula too, but hey,
we're saving
that's for the next Beyond Naschy episode. So, hang loose. Thank you, Elena. Always good to hear from you, even when you attack us and are mean-spirited and cruel.
Yeah.
But that's what we're used to.
But she still dedicates songs to us on her great show, Horror Rises from Spain. Check out Horror Rises from Spain on Cult Radio A Go-Go.
Cult Radio A Go-Go, baby. All right, cool. Thank you, Elena. Always worth getting email from her. And we get our first email. Oh, by the way, in Brad's email, he mentioned the B-Movie podcast.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not listening to the B-Movie podcast, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, really good show.
Great show, really a lot of fun, and they try to go out of their way to not spoil films in general, and they talk about one, sometimes two films a shot. They talk about them, they chew them over, discuss them, and it's great. They have a much wider range than we do, of course, which is great, which means they can discuss anything from Forbidden Planet to The Devil Bat. To, you know, biker films, just whatever they want to discuss, which is really cool, and it makes the film, it makes the podcast have a whole lot of neat variety, and it's something well worth checking out.
Yeah.
Well, we got this week an email from Vince Rotolo, the host of the B-Movie podcast, and he wrote in, he says, "Hello, Naschy Cast. I thought I would give you my Exorcist experience. I was 22 at the time, and I was raised Catholic. I saw the film in 1973 at a downtown Pittsburgh theater. It was one of the old theaters. It was a one-screen huge building with a balcony, and it was very ornate. Anyway, I went with two of my friends. We stood in a long line, probably two blocks long."
Mm.
I haven't done that in a while. So we got in, went up to the balcony, sat down, and I remember it was early house light down. And I remember Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells playing in the background. And if that wasn't bad enough, there was a bunch of strange people saying prayers on rosary beads.
Wow. That's
so fantastic. We were freaked out before the film even started. Needless to say, the movie scared the crap out of us. We went back home and stayed up till about 2 a.m. talking because everybody was scared to go to bed. Cheers, Vince and the gang.
Oh, now, man, I believe
that's a good story.
I remember, of course, you know, I was too young to go to the theater to see it, so it held this, you know, it was even more of a fascinating thing to me because I was still very aware of the whole hype and the whole Exorcist craze that was going on around the country about this film. So being barred, you know, not being able to go see it, even though I was, you know, my parents allowed me to watch general horror movies that were on TV, but this was something altogether, you know, I don't blame them for not taking me. You know, I hold nothing against them for not taking me. I can understand, as liberal as they were with that sort of thing, why they would not take me to see that film. But I just remember hearing the radio promos. You know, we'd be riding in the car and it would come on, because you remember those are the days back when you remember when you heard radio promos on the, you know, music promos on the radio quite frequently. You know, you hear that all the time. And it would come on with the Tubular Bells playing, and you know, and you'd hear the great voice of what was her name, Mercedes McCambridge, that did the you know, going, "What a lovely day for an exorcism," you know, and you just hear that music and you're just like, "Oh, holy shit!" This is like the scariest movie ever made, and it damn near was.
I gotta say, I didn't see it until home video, of course.
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
And this was back in the day before we even had a VCR. The way I saw it was we actually rented a VCR and The Exorcist.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how I talked my dad into I don't even remember how old I was. I was probably, 12, 13, 14, somewhere around in there.
Yeah.
And, boy, the fact that it was just on videotape and, you know, crouched down in front of a television didn't alter the fact that thing, you know, ripped into me.
Yeah, yeah.
I've watched that thing quite a few times. I've gotten to see the original cut on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten to see the revised edit several years ago. And I've watched it a number of times, and it's still incredibly effective. It's still just an incredibly effective film.
Yes.
And I kind of like having two different versions of the film.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
Because I kind of get a kick out of both. Mm-hmm. And I love knowing that some of the differences in the re-edit that he made were to make William Peter Blatty happy about some of the things that he had kind of wanted to be left in, some differences he'd always had with Friedkin, so he made those changes. Kind of nice, because I love having two versions of it.
Yeah.
You know, one hasn't supported the other. Both are very interesting. Fascinating. Thanks for writing in, Vince. It's always great to hear somebody's experience seeing a classic movie, especially at during the time when it was blowing up, when it was something really, really huge, and everybody was talking about it, because I was too young. I was, good Lord, in 73 I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. so not really happening for me. So
no.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Vince. Everybody listen to Vince's show, the B-Movie Cast. Go out and find it. It's very good.
B-Movie Podcast is worth your time, folks, I'm telling you. And I do occasionally call in and make nonsensical statements.
Yeah, as an extra, you sometimes get a cameo from Rod on there.
I try to be slightly, well, funny occasionally. All right, that'll wrap it up for the emails for right now. Thanks to everyone for listening in. Remember, the next podcast, the next NashiCast, will be us covering Vengeance of the Zombies.
Mm-hmm.
I've only ever watched this one once, man.
That's once more than me, and I've not heard good things about it. Well, I'm going to see. I'm interested to see how it's going to hold up, but it's a new one on me. I hadn't seen
My
it.
Memories are not overly positive.
So it may be battling Crimson for the last place on our butt, you know. But we should go into it with an open mind.
I'm going into it with an open mind. I'm going to watch it off of Blu-ray. At the very least.
Yeah, like you said, it's one of only two Nashi films on Blu-ray.
So hey, here we go. I am really enjoying the fact that we're getting into some of the films that we don't know that well.
Yeah.
Vengeance of the Zombies is one that doesn't get talked about a lot, but This should be interesting. It's also one that I think since it was put out by BCI, it's easier to get your hands on. Therefore, when we get into the discussion of this, I bet
everybody will be able to see it and be able to cool.
So all right, folks, I guess we'll say Cheery bye.
And cheery bye.
And talk to you again next time here in a few weeks when we come at you with episode 20.
Mm-hmm.
This is Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we'll see you later.